We have 10 plagues. Maybe we have more. Maybe there are 11 plagues, right? Consider that how maybe in the past they have an article or an essay in one of my books on the 11th plague, which the splitting of the sea, if you didn't guess what which the 11th was, and why do we count 10 and not 11? So there's 10 plagues which are in Egypt. Now, there is a tendency to make some assumptions about plagues simply by comparing some to others and then saying, oh, therefore this greater truth must be obvious. And I'll explain to you exactly what I mean by that. So how many of the 10 plagues does it say that it struck only the Egyptians and not the Jews? So, by the way, even if my formulating the question like that is limited, because there are some that put it like this, there are some that talk about not the nation or authenticity, but rather speak about location and talk about Goshen versus other places. So the truth is, in order to do this properly, you have to now go back to the very beginning and read all 10 plagues and then take a look carefully and seeing, so what does it say by each one? But then, of course, one can go a little bit further and also use the Midrashim or use certain commentaries. So again, for example, I think some of us will remember either a visual or having been explained at some point how when Dam, during when it was turned to blood, the water turned to blood, so that you can have two people drinking out of the same cup of water. Now, why an Egyptian and a Jew or Hebrew were drinking out of the same cup of water, that I don't know, but it was a nice visual where this straw is, I don't know what exactly they were drinking. I guess this one had his ice cream float from Carvel. And certainly. And this one was having blood come out instead, which again was a very good way to teach us. Well, look at the distinction between the two, and they got the plagues and we didn't, which is interesting because there's no hint of the distinction when it comes to Dam. On the other hand, then you can say to yourself, hold it. Why should the Jews have been punished as well? What did we do? Which then takes you to another point. To what extent are the various plagues punishments, and to what extent are they displays of God's power? Which means, especially when you think about the Nile, and this was one of the points of the supposed divinity of Paro, that he's the god of the Nile, and therefore to control the Nile, for everyone to see, by the way, would have been a display of power. So maybe that was, the reality was, that everything turned to blood for everybody, so that everybody can see that display of power. So that's why it's interesting that sometimes when you're going to, you know, overplay your hand, you may end up in a place which is not where you're supposed to end up. It's because essentially you read it as punishment instead of reading it as display of power, and then you've ended up, instead of, yes, limiting the punishment, but also limiting the display of power. And that's why I'm saying that one needs to be a little bit more careful before reading this. Again, it's very clear to me that there are commentaries that read them into all of them. And one, I think, does have to be a little bit more careful in terms of the language. Now, the major focus that I want to get to today is really going to be the last three, which are in this week's Parsha. And certain things, again, along that point about who was struck and how they're struck. And there's something which is very interesting, and I'd actually go a little bit further and say there's something very disturbing. But let's begin. We're going to begin in the middle, and that is with darkness, with Choshech. Vayomer Hashem Moshe netei yadcha al hashamayim v'yihi Choshech al eretz Mitzrayim v'yimash v'yimesh Choshech. Now again, darkness is something which is significant. Paro, or in Egypt, where they believed in all kinds of gods, there was no contradiction to be a god of Nile, but also to be the sun god, and sun god is one of the major forces in Egypt, and therefore, over here, for the sun god to be eclipsed, and for there to be darkness, that would be a major statement. Over here, there's also an interesting way of describing it. So why did I need that addition towards the end of the verse? What did that? And the Gemara makes it sound it's a different kind of darkness. It's not the kind of darkness of a lack of sun. It's a kind of darkness which one can feel. But nonetheless, that first part and the second part, those two different clauses, it was dark and then Vayamesh Choshech. So what does one do with that? So I'm saying there are various possibilities. Vayet Moshe et yado al hashamayim v'choshech afela b'chol eretz Mitzrayim shloshet yamim. And there was darkness for 3 days. And by the way, maybe we'll see further. There are midrashim that say it was 6 days. How did you get to 6 days? I just said 3 days. So that's by virtue of saying that those are two different elements of this. And because there's two different elements, each element lasted for 3 days. And then you have 6 days of darkness. I once used to sit in a Beit Midrash where there was a fellow who today is one of the Dayanim of the Eda Charedis, one of the heads of the Eda, not just the Dayan, one of the heads. And I would talk to him occasionally. And it was, you could talk to him on almost any issue of Torah. It was fine, but till you got to issues that had to do with Zionism. So he referred to the 6 Day War as the 6 days of darkness, the six days of Afela. Instead of saying these are 6 days of a Gilui Shechina, where God appears with all His might, the 6 days of darkness, and following the theology of the Satmar Rebbe, of Rabbi Yoel. These are 6 days where the Sitra Achra, where he's able to confuse everybody into what's right is wrong and wrong is right and so on. But in order to get to his 6 days of darkness, he did have to follow that line in the Midrash that sees that there's three and three. And I can still surprise you. This is so shocking. Okay, continue. Then in Pasuk Kaf Gimel it says, Lo ra'u ish et achiv, V'lo kamu ish mitachat shlosha imim, mitachtav shlosha imim. Again, are those the same things, or each one is 3 days? I'm saying that's where the intrigue comes in. U'lechol b'nei Yisrael haya'or b'moshevotam. And all of Israel had light. Now, what does it mean when it says b'moshevotam? Does that mean in Eretz Goshen? Or does that mean in wherever they live? Or does that mean wherever they are at this time? Because it sounds like it's locale centric. That's what it sounds like. That in the Jewish neighborhoods, in the Jewish area, then there was light. Which also shows how God is God of, go back to that image of the two straws. So instead over here, you have somebody looking outside and seeing the sun is shining in this area and the sun is dark, no, not in that area. That is actually an incredible display. But again, as opposed to Dam, over here it actually says it. So and it sounds that it doesn't mean any further than this. So just for example, if a Jew were to walk into the house of an Egyptian, would he be a walking flashlight? Would there be light for him? And for nobody else in that area. And I'm just saying the quick, simple read does not suggest that, but then we're going to have to see exactly what happens by the time we get to the Midrashim. Look at the Seichel Tov in source number 2. L'chol b'nei Yisrael haya or b'moshevotam haynu Goshen. So yeah, Goshen. And incidentally, one then would have to explain why by some of the other plagues, specifically it does say Goshen as opposed to Mitzrayim, but over here it's as opposed to Mitzrayim. Actually, it is Bechol Eretz Mitzrayim as opposed to Moshevotam. So again, I'm not terribly bothered by this question. And he says Upshita Dekrahu. I'll say what we would today call Pshat, the simple. If you want me to be extreme, I'll say the correct reading is that it was dependent upon location. This location had light and this location had darkness. Aval, but he's well aware that there are other midrashim of Rabboteinu Darshin, b'moshevotam d'mitzrayim shahayu Yisrael nechnasim l'batei mitzrayim v'notlin nechaseihem ve'einon margishin v'alei mefurash b'kabbalah raglei chasdav yishmor v'rashim b'choshech yidmo. So he says, yeah, but the rabbis, liked playing with this and going a little bit further with this and suggesting, therefore, that if a Jew did go into the Egyptian's house, then they would not be, the Egyptians wouldn't sense he was there, and you can just walk in and take anything you want. Now, that's a really interesting way of putting this, On the other hand, if we look in source number 3, which is Medrash Rabbah, which is a little bit more normative, uvishloshet yemei afela, natan HaKadosh Baruch Hu chein ha'am b'nei Mitzrayim v'hish'ilum. This is part of the long con, which means the long, they're trying to fool them here along the way. It's a setup. Because during the 3 days, Shahaya Yisrael nichnas l'toch bateim shamitzrayim v'hayu ro'im b'hem klei kesef v'klei zov u'smalot. That this is when they did window shopping. You walked into the house of the Egyptians, you looked around, you see exactly what they had. By the way, as opposed to the previous source that we saw that they walked away with it, over here it says, no, they did inventory. Im hayu omrim ein lanu la'ashir lachem. If they said, oh, no, we don't have anything to lend to you, hayu sol omrim lahen, harehu b'makom ploni. No, you have it, and here's exactly the place in your house that you have it. Boto sha'a hayo mitzrim omrim. At that point, they said, kind of like a kal v'chomer, maybe even amigo. He says, im hayu elu rotsim l'shaker banu. If they really want to deceive us, I'm not going to use that as lie, but really to deceive us, they could have just taken it from us during the time of darkness and we wouldn't have sensed it. And therefore they decided to lend it to them. And this is how God went about to fulfill the promise made to Avram, and then they're going to leave with great wealth. So therefore, now we've turned the darkness, again, notice we've completely ignored the sun god and the possible theological implications of this, but rather we're doing this as a preparation to leave with wealth as was promised to Avraham. So this is essentially when the Jews get to case the joint and take a look what's going on, what's where. But more than that, they also get the sympathy of the Egyptians, who now realize if they wanted to rob us, they would have. So therefore, we'll lend it to them because they want. It could have just have been theirs. And it says, "Hadu dichtiv l'chol bnei Yisrael ha'ya'or," and that's what it means. And for the Jews, there was light, be'eretz Goshen, lo ne'amar ela b'moshvotam. And he's saying, no, it didn't say in Eretz Goshen. It says wherever they were, b'chol moshvotam. But moshvotam doesn't mean wherever you're walking. It means really where you live. Shekol makom shaha Yehudi nichnas haya'or nichnas u'me'ir lo ma'she b'chaviyot u'v'tevot u'v'matmoniot. That they then, the light was showing them what's hidden, where the safe is and what's here, and therefore you have a wonderful light which is now helping to facilitate our leaving Egypt with great wealth. So therefore, what this midrash is doing, again, it's fascinating. It's comparing with other places where it said Goshen as opposed to Moshvotam. What it's doing is also, it's connecting to the larger story where they're going to have to leave with their great wealth. And therefore, this whole plague of darkness becomes a way for God to facilitate this. We have flashlights. But not just flashlights, showing us exactly where all the valuables are. Later on, when we get to the leaving, next week in Parshat Shalach, V'yisavu lukim ata am derech ha-midbar yamsuf, v'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Yisrael. Now, what does the word chamushim mean? So Rashi over here, and it's a long Rashi I skipped. Those three dots are lots and lots of v'chamushim. So Rashi writes, ein chamushim ela mezuyanim. What does chamushim mean? They were armed. The Jews were armed and dangerous. That's what chamush means. And it's what it means in the context, and it's pshat. And then Rashi pulls out, for whatever reason, I guess we're going to have to try to understand this reason, he pulls out, for whatever reason, davar acher. Oh, you know, there's another explanation. Chamushim means echad machamisha yatsu, v'arba chalakim metu b'shloshet yimei afela. And says, and this is also one of these things that we've all heard as kids, which is very interesting how Rashi presents this as a davar acher, which he would seem to know that it's not the pshat in the pasuk, as per his first interpretation, which is superior, again, contextually. And he says, oh, 4/5 died, 80% of the Jews died. And that's difficult on so many levels. I mean, it's hard enough to figure out how we got to 600,000 men between 20 and 60 over those years in Egypt. And now you're going to say, yeah, but that was just 20, that's just 20% of them. And there were so many more people, so that is difficult. But indeed, Rashi is quoting from the Mechilta, which is a quite authoritative source. And the Mechilta, although realized in some places, the Mechilta, even though it's generally a halachic midrash, In some place, it provides us some of the material that we have in the Haggadah, where it says, oh, there were 50 miracles on the sea. No, there were 200. And the more that you can do a drasha, I mean, that's what we're like, right? We don't actually hit people, but we make a drasha that they got hit 50 times. No, I made a drasha they got 200 times. No, they got 250 times, and it makes us feel better. And part of this is also because this is a prototype for the future redemption, and we're already enjoying the punishment of our enemies. And I'm saying that's a part of it. It's not so much, sorry for me saying this, it's not so much pshat in the pasuk. Along the same lines, we get the following. And I say along the same lines, it's actually much more difficult. V'hayu ki yom aleichem b'neichem, b'sora ra nitbarsu Yisrael b'oto sha'a, sh'sof ha'tora atida l'shtakeach. Well, your kids are going to say, hold it, what's going on over here? And I think some of you have heard me say before, for us, in retrospect, to have children who don't know what happened in Egypt is very, very painful. But for people in Egypt to be told that one day you're going to be free and your kids are going to be free and they're not going to know of slavery and they're going to ask you, what's the slavery all about? That's a bracha. That's a bracha, which means depending which way you look at it. And by the way, the psukim say that they were thankful and they bowed down and to God when they heard this message. And God says, for having children like this, sorry, Rashi brings down, they're going to celebrate for having children like this who are going to be born of freedom. Born not knowing even of the past. Again, very simply, you tell somebody in Auschwitz, in the middle of hell, that you're going to have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and they're going to be born free people in their own country, and they're not even going to know about this slavery. So yeah, there is this bitter educational failure, which in reality pales compared to freedom. So it's interesting over here, the Mechilta is giving you the retrospective interpretation as opposed to the real-time understanding of this. The time is going to become, the Torah is going to be forgotten. So here it gives you that flip side that I just now said. The flip side is that they were just told, I'm going to have children, grandchildren, who are going to be free. So that's why they're so happy about it. So it's two sides. I'm going to say it again. The two sides are, do I look at it real-time, looking forward and seeing the freedom, or do I look at it in the future, looking backwards, say, hold it, why don't my kids know enough? And by the way, the reality is they're both true. They're both true, but it depends who you're looking at. The person who is enslaved and to hear that you can have children who are free is an unbelievable bracha. Then once you have children that are free, you don't even know about their past, so now there's I'm understating it by saying there's an educational challenge. Yeah? Wow. Well,
I marched for you.
I was actually in the Soviet Union when he was released. Naomi and I, we were sent by the Israeli government. We were teaching and we had a couple of missions that we needed to do. And I walked into a shul in Leningrad, which was towards the end, and somebody there said, Natan Babayit. And also we knew him as Anatoly. And he said, Natan Babayit. And I'm looking at him, I said, what Natan? He goes, Natan Babayit. I said, what Natan? And again, they're afraid to talk. Really, yeah. And he said, Sharansky. And by the way, we were called in for questioning with the KGB and the whole thing. And I know when the memoirs come out, they're gonna be interesting. Anyway, some people like to exaggerate. Okay, let's continue. And then it continues. Lama hishtachavu mishum shenemar v'chamushim alu bnei Yisrael. Echad mi'chamisha, and it says, no, why did they bow down? Because so many of them didn't make it out, and they're being told that people are going to make it out, and it's a response to having children, because so many had died. So that's where this comes in, and it says, no, only 20% made it out. And then it says, no, okay, and some say, no, it wasn't 20%. It's only 1 out of 50 made it out. And some say, no, only 1 out of 500 made it out. Again, sorry for saying this, this exaggeration is trying to highlight to what extent people were overjoyed to find out that they're actually going to have children and continuity and there's going to be survival. But nonetheless, what did we just now do? So you didn't even realize that, I said before, 20%, that was an exaggeration. And now you're looking and saying, well, 20%, that was like the low number. The high number of those who perished is unbelievable. Rav Naharai Omer Havodah V'lo Echad Michamesh Mot Alu Shenema Revavrak Kitzemech, and so on and so forth. The script a little bit of Ve'ematai Metu, and when did they die? B'shloshit Yimei Afila. They died during the 3 days of darkness. Shenemar, lo ra'u ish et achiv, shahayu korvin meitehim v'hodu v'shivchu, shelo ra'u evim v'samchu b'mapalatan. And therefore they died during these 3 days of darkness. And why were they happy? They were happy because now their enemies don't see. Now, by the way, I find the disconnect over here incredibly jarring. On the one hand, during the 3 days of darkness, we're shopping in our neighbors' gardens. On the other hand, we're burying numbers of dead, which are beyond any possible imagination. And what in the world just now happened? Because if the purpose of the darkness is a punishment for the Egyptians, so why are we getting punished like this? Which means it seems to go so much against the texture or the feeling of the text of what we're reading right now. We're reading about this moment where the Egyptians are suffering and we have light. Oh yeah, we have light so we can have funerals and bury the people. Where we bury the people and they don't see it. And again, there's just something very, very jarring about this interpretation. If you look at Rashi, if you first look at source number 7, Yecheskel, it says, Vayimru bi, right? They rebelled against me. Velo avu l'shmoa elai, they don't want to listen to me. Ish et shikutzei einehem, lo hishlichu, ve'et gulei mitzrayim lo azavu. They didn't get rid of their avodah zarah. They didn't leave all of this paganism. Again, Egypt is mentioned. V'omar l'shvoch chamati aleihem, and there, which is interesting, because shmoch chamatcha we bring in, and over here, and they're alagoyim, and people get all very upset. And over here, it's actually the verse says shmoch chamati aleihem l'chalota pibahem b'toch eretz Mitzrayim. That's a very interesting verse. Here, Rashi uses that as the interpretation. V'yamru bi hem harishaim. Rubam shel Yisrael shemetu b'shloshet yemei afela. Most of the Jews died during those 3 days. K'moshe nemar v'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael. And over here, Rashi brings his interpretation again. That davar acher, that other interpretation. Here he brings it. Echad machamishim v'yesh omer echad machamesh meir. And it's also interesting. 1 of 50, or some actually say 1 out of 500. So again, this is, I would say, quite disturbing. But by the way, note, over here, Echad Michamishim, he doesn't say 1 in 5. Echad Michamishim, V'yeshomer Echad Michameshmeot. He actually brings the higher numbers over here. And he doesn't bring the lower number of only 20% survived, that 80% were killed. Over here, when I say over here, meaning on the Pasuk without darkness, in Source 9, Rashi says, V'choshech afila shloshet yamim, Choshech shel ofel, shelo ru'u ish et achav otan shlosha yamim, va'od shloshet yamim acherim, choshech mechupal al zeh. Shelo komu ish mitachtav, yoshev ein yachol lamod, v'amod ein yachol leshev. V'lama hevi aleim choshech, and why does God bring the plague of darkness? Shayu b'nei Yisrael ba'oto hador rishaim. Actually, it's very interesting what the definition of Rishaim here, and this is where I want to pause, because you know later on we're going to get to the splitting of the sea, and we'll have the angels come down and say Elu of the Avodah Zarah, Elu of the Avodah Zarah. These people are idolaters, and these are idolaters. Which, by the way, would have been very easy to state as the meaning of that verse in Yecheskel we just now saw. The other way around. That it sounds like the idolaters don't make it out. So then, how do we have a later teaching saying, "No, they're idolaters. They're idolaters." And let's be honest. As we continue our narrative, there seems to be some regression. We go back towards idolatry. We get to the golden calf and so on. So therefore, is it really fair to say that all the idolaters were gone already? So over here, what are the Rishaim? He says, "Umeitu b'shoshu shmeifida." 1 second. Who are they? Who are the wicked people? So I hope nobody living overseas will listen to this. It says that the wicked people are the ones who don't want to leave the exile. The ones that, I didn't say that. You just said that. I didn't say that. I don't remember saying that. I just now heard. He goes, they're wicked. They're wicked. No, but that's fascinating. Rashi's saying is that when God says, I'm taking you out, and you don't want to leave, you want to stay where you are, and Rashi is saying that that was the wickedness. The wickedness is the denial of the mitzvah of the day. The mitzvah of the day is Yitziat Mitzrayim. You don't want to be a part of Yitziat Mitzrayim. So that's it. We're getting rid of you. Again, there are going to be some commentaries who are going to go a little bit further along this line, but this is actually fascinating. Look, I have no doubt what my uber Zionist wife is going to do when I repeat this. We'll see. Maybe I'll say it in shul on Shabbos. We'll see. If you look at Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky in Source 10, where it's bold, V'imkein madua metu dafka rishayim elu v'lo kol rishayim. Right, this plan, and he quotes this point about elu of deravodas, elu of deravodas. So why do these people? V'nira mishum she elu hayirot simla akev biyadeim shalachere milatzeit. Which, by the way, is either physical or trying to convince them. Are you crazy? Are you going to go to Israel? How are you going to go there? Where are you going to go to the desert? Are you going to leave? Egypt is so nice. By the way, I was supposed to actually be speaking in New York this Shabbos. Can you imagine what I would have been saying? maybe it was the hand of God. And people always ask me, come on, are you willing to say these things? I say, yeah. And he goes, and they invite you back? I said, yeah. No, because I'm there. I say it, and then they can ignore it. Okay. But by the way, at the very end, Rav Yaakov says something, and I've cited this before, but I do want to cite it again. And look at the end of the paragraph, the second paragraph there. V'nitzayer na la'atzmenu, mahita hargashatam shel b'nei Yisrael b'meshach yimei makot choshech. And he goes, if we're going to now take this seriously, or literally, that so many people died, then what do you think they felt like? Again, mahaya hargashatam shel b'nei Yisrael b'meshach yimei makot choshech, shoi ro'im him sh'Yisrael lo kim yoter min ha-mitzrim, that we're suffering more than the Egyptians are. He goes, do the numbers figured out. And by the way, he just now got to numbers which are very close. Levad mitaf zakenim v'nashim. Right? 600,000 leaving. So he's saying, he's ending up with a number of 6 million, by the way. And they had no idea why this was happening. Now look what he does with this, how he flips this. What did God do to us? And this, right now, this was written during World War II. And he said, that is the thing which can comfort us. That we have bitter complaints against the ways that God runs the world, but nogeya leklal Yisrael, regarding what's happening to the Jewish people, aval lefize, according to what we now notice, mashma, it seems, she'anu krovim legeula. It means we must be very close to the actual redemption. Because this happened, the darkness happened right before the redemption. So he's saying that also, this terrible darkness that we're going through must be very close to the redemption. So I think it's just a fascinating observation, because it would be so easy to take the exact same thing and say, oh, look what's, you know. But nonetheless, it's very difficult. Again, he's saying, let's feel how they felt, and he's assuming that this is pshat. And I'm having difficulty understanding how this could be pshat when what's really happening is God said, no, the Egyptians are of darkness and we have light. Oh, we have light. Okay, then you have this teaching. Oh, we would like to see where their money is. Okay, so that's interesting when we go into their house as well. But we're too busy burying millions of, again, it just goes beyond imagination to understand this. And then again, what is their wickedness? Their wickedness is they don't want to leave. They wanted to stay where they were. And what is their wickedness? Their wickedness, they want to talk other people out of leaving or making aliyah. Sorry for saying that as well. I was almost going to say that. You heard me almost say that 100%. Because now as you continue, then you keep hearing these same voices. And that's in a sense, I guess, what's really happening. In just to go back a little bit, in Source 11 is by the Arov, there it says clearly it will be Malo Mitzrayim et Arov. It will be in Egypt. V'fleiti b'yomahu et Eretz Goshen asher ami omer aleha levodi ayot sham orev. So here it's very location, you know, oriented. Egypt, but not Goshen, where my people are. In source number 12, we see, right, speak to him, shlach et ami. If you don't, hani. So by Dever, it says again, V'hifla Hashem bein miknei Yisrael ubein miknei Mitzrayim. So over here, instead of being purely based upon location, it is a punishment of money and resources and what you own. So if you own, if a Jew owns it, it will survive. If a non, if an Egyptian owns it, it will die. And then at the end of this, it says, V'yamat kol Mikne Mitzrayim u Mikne Bnei Yisrael lo meit echad, and it's interesting. Veishlach Paro v'nei lo meit Mikne Yisrael ad echad. Question is what ad echad means, but I do want you to pay attention to that language. Moving a little bit further, we get to the Barad, which will be towards the end of last week's parsha. Vayacha Barad, and then here pasuk avav rak be'eretz Goshen asher sham bnei Yisrael lo haya Barad. So again, the distinction is between the location. So now you realize that it's not consistent, but it's not consistent more so because of the nature of that particular plague, as opposed to, you know, issues that I need there to be the exact same language. Would it make sense by all of them? I mean, that's ownership, and that happens to be with location. When we get to source 14, right? Now we're in Parshat Bo. Vayavo Moshe va'Aaron al Paro v'yomei lov kom Hashem elokei Avrim ha'matayim ha'anta lanot v'penayin shlach ami ve'avduni. And if not, you're going to get arbeh. Okay, so now we're up to locusts. V'kisa et eina aretz v'lo yuchal lirot et aretz v'chal et yetro b'leitan esheret lachem min ha'barad v'chal et kol ha'etz v'tzameach lachem min ha'sadeh. And over here, actually, I want to pause here for a moment. So again, this is the beginning of this week's parasha, but I want to say something more about Choshech and death and Jews and Egyptians. After we get to Choshech, the very next one, again, I said I want to talk about all three this week. Let's wait for locusts for a moment. But we think about Makat Bechorot for a moment. So the plague comes. So theoretically, it should be like some of the other plagues, and only Egypt is struck. But over here, there's actually seems to be a concern, and the concern expressed by God. And it's the way that he teaches us this, and he says, oh, make sure you put, you know, the blood on your doorposts. So when the plague comes, the plague is only going to hit them and not you. Now, that's such a strange thing. Because, again, this is the same God, at least on a theoretical level, could have made the ice cream float half blood and half ice cream float. But even though, let's be fair, it doesn't say that there. Okay, what about darkness? It did say it by darkness. It did say this by some of the other plagues, that God makes the distinction. Why, when it comes to the death of the firstborn, does it say, oh no, we have to be proactive then, and we have to put the blood because the plague is going to come and make sure it doesn't hit us and only hits them? So that is a little concerning. And now, if I go back to Choshech, leading up to that point, and I say, hold it, Choshech, you know, maybe struck us as well as them. Again, what troubles me, okay, I'll say it this way. As it leads into the last plague, so then maybe I can begin to understand it, but standing on itself, I have a very difficult time understanding it. It's only when we think about, no, there is just this general plague which is taking place, and those who are unworthy are going to die, then I can make a little bit of a leap and say, ah, you see, and even those who are unworthy die during those 3 days of darkness. As I said, I can say all of this, but I think also, as you sense, I don't necessarily love all of this. Which that is what really brings me back to locusts. Because when I read it by itself, it may be a little bit different, but I want to be a little bit more careful here and start all over again. Source 14. Vayavo Moshe va'Aaron el Paro v'yomer lov kor amar Hashem elokei Avrim ha'matayim ha'anta lanot mipanai shalach ami v'avduni. Okay, how long are you going to resist? How long are you going to desist from doing what you should be doing? Let my people go and serve me. Ki im ma'ein atah l'shloach atami, hinei mivi machar arbem begvulacha, I'm going to send locust. Now realize that to a great extent, Egypt has already been trashed. and economically, you know, destroyed. V'chiseet ein ha'aretz v'lo yachol lir'ot, which I've pointed this out before, the common denominator of all three of the plagues in this week's parsha is darkness. It's this inability to see over here. It's the darkness of the darkness, and then the makot b'chorot, which takes place in the middle of the night, as opposed to other times. That is the common denominator over here, which was probably particularly noticed by people who were fans of the sun god. That becomes something somewhat more theologically devastating. V'chalet yeter ha'plita nisharet lachem min ha'barad, and anything which made it after the barad is about to go. V'chalet kol ha'etz ha'tzomech lachem min ha'sadeh, and everything that you have is going to be destroyed. Umalu batecha u batei kol avdecha u batei kumatzorem asher lo ra'u avotecha, v'avot avotecha meyom ha'itam al adama ad yom hazeh v'yifin v'yitzei me'im paro, and they turned around and walked out. V'yom mor avdei paro elav ad matay yezel lanu l'mokesh. Right, for how long is this going to be a thorn in our side? Shalach et anashim v'yavdu et Elohe et Hashem Eloheim, let them serve their God. By the way, there's still not an acknowledgement of God being the ultimate and only God. Haterem teda ki avda Mitzrayim, don't you know that Egypt is lost? Which is such a wonderful thing to say over here, because the very fact that servants are talking back to Paro and telling him what to do is an indication of what they're saying is that Egypt is lost. I mean, this is not the advisors, this is not the magicians, this is not the royalty. This is the avadim, avdei Paro, are telling him, do it, it's over. Vayushav et Moshe et Aaron el Paro, and they were returned. Vayomer lehem l'chuv du et Hashem Elokechem. So again, go serve your God. Mi umi ahochim v'yom ha'moshe min arenu v'zekneinu nelech. We're going with our young, we're going with our old. Banenu v'datenu, male and female. B'tzoneinu v'kareinu nelech. Ki chag Hashem lanu. We're taking our flocks, we're taking everything, we're going. V'yom ha'leim yihichen, Hashem imachem. Which is actually, you know, fascinating. May God be with you. Kasher shalechatchem v'et tapchem. Ru'u ki ra'ah neged pneichem. And this ra'ah we've discussed before as well, because Rashi has a tradition that this is the Egyptian god of Ra, which is coming out over here, because it actually, something interesting happens. Okay, you go, you serve and whatever, and then suddenly there's a turnaround, and that turnaround is right after this. Lo kein, meaning he mentions Ra and he becomes bold again, he becomes brave again, and he says, Lo kein, l'chu na gvarim, only men need to go to shul. L'chu na gvarim, v'ivdu et Hashem, ki otam etem mevakshim, v'garesh otam mi'ed p'nei paro. So Moshe's point is we're going with the men and the women and the children and the boys and the girls and the elderly, because, and by the way, this is true. How do we celebrate our holidays? We celebrate our holidays with the entire family. That's how we celebrate holidays. And especially the flock, because he needs something to eat. And he says, and he's saying, no, you know, only the men need to serve and no one else needs to go. So that's also, I think, there is what to say about that back and forth. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe neteyadcha al Eretz Mitzrayim ba'arbeh. Okay, you're gonna lift your arm. You're gonna bring arbeh, locust. Vayal al Eretz Mitzrayim ve'ochalat kol esav aret et kol asher hishir barad. And anything that still survived, it will now be destroyed. Vayet Moshe et matehu al Eretz Mitzrayim. Vashem nihag. Is that the word? Vashem nihag ruach kadim ba'aretz. Kol hayom hahu v'chol halayla, haboker haya v'ruach kin masa et ha'arbe. And an east wind blew the entire evening, and in the morning, the arbe, the locust, had blown in. So I want to point something out, that it could be that we don't remember, we didn't think about it, or we didn't notice this, how this exact happens. Listen, let's be honest. There's so much other stuff going on in the Suk's Parsha. I forgive you for not noticing exactly how the locust ended up over here. But now you see that I bolded, and now you see that I'm pausing, and now you see I'm going to talk about it. It's this east wind brings it in, and it's not the only occurrence of an east wind. It's not the only occurrence of an east wind which is blowing all night. And that's something that we need to pay attention to, because as I said from the very beginning, it is this comparison between one plague and the other which is interesting, especially when we don't even notice that it may be a plague. V'yal arbe al kol eretz Mitzrayim, v'yunach b'chol gvul Mitzrayim, kaved ma'od lefanav, lo yachein arbe kamo v'acharev lo yachein, kein, and it was so extreme that it was never anything like this, never will be. V'yichas et ein kol ha'aretz, v'tichshach ha'aretz, so again, that interesting language. It's like the eye of the land was covered and now there's darkness, which then you realize really is foreshadowing for what's going to happen next, which is going to be the darkness. It's Vayomer Paro Kohen Moshe l'Aaron, Vayomer Chatati l'Hashem Elokeichem v'lachem. Again, Elokeichem. I've sinned against your God and against you. V'tasana chatoti achpam v'tir l'Hashem Elokeichem v'yasar me'elai rak et ha'mavet hazeh. And he calls this death, which is interesting. You could have called something death all the way through. V'yetzimim paro v'yiter l'Hashem. V'yafoch Hashem ruach yam chazak ma'od v'yisa et ha'arbeh v'yitakehu yama suf lo nishar arbe echad. And the wind then gets turned around in the other direction, and a very strong wind, and it takes the arbor away, and it takes them to the Yam Suf, and not lo nishar arbe echad, and not even one remained. Now, if you didn't notice this, then I hope at least you're tempted now to look further, and to see how similar the language is over here, compared to what happens by the splitting of the sea, because the language is really, really quite close. Let's look at source 17. Vayet Moshe Yedo al Hayam Vayolech Hashem et Hayam Beruach Kadim Aza Kol Halayla V'yashav et Hayam L'chorva Yivku Mayim. Which means, am I going to tell you it's the exact same words? It's pretty close. It's the same description. Which means we now realize that the plague of the locusts, to a certain extent, was a foreshadowing of what's going to happen. And also, if you didn't notice this, also, where does it end up? It ends up by the Yam Suf, which is where they're going to end up as well, which means, just again, as far as great literary foreshadowing, you, again, if you never noticed this, you never realized this, the plague of locusts is wonderful foreshadowing what's going to happen. Lo nishar arbe echad. I mean, look at Pasuk Kafchet, right? Lo nishar bahem ad echad. And that's talking about the Egyptians, and it's talking about the locusts. And now, again, you just have to look at this. Where else was the language exactly the same? Here in Pasuk Yotet, Vayafoch Hashem Ruach Yam Chazak Ma'od. And there in Pasuk Kafchet, in Source 17, is Vayashuvu Hamayim. Right? And the water turns around, or return. In this case, it returns. In that case, it's Vayafoch. It gets turned around. But as I said, it's something that we may not have noticed. And again, if we're already not noticing, I want to point out that this east wind was actually mentioned one time before. When? It's mentioned in Source 18, which is in Paro's dream, which I hope you realize that if it's Paro's dream, that is not as disassociated as you may have thought. That was Paro's dream regarding the seven bad years, the crop which was destroyed. Now just think about that for a second, about the crop that was destroyed. V'yishan v'chalom shenit, right? I am in Source 18. And v'hinei sheva shibulim olot b'kanei achad b'riot v'torot, v'hinei sheva shibulim dakot u'shivot kadim tzomchot ancharehim. Which means over here, it is this eastwardly wind which is coming, which then destroys the sheaves, which will then create the seven bad years. If you look at Rashi, let's get the Rashi there first. The Rashi is in Source 19, 20, 21, 22, and 23, and 24 are all going to be telling you how bad the east wind is. And it's just coming up in all kinds of different places. Do we have one on that itself, on his dream? Very next source, 19. V'shidafot belaz shikufin kidum chavutot lashon mashkofa chavut tamid al yedei hadela tamaka kadim ruach mizrachit. So it's actually this combination of two things. He's saying is that you have like this wind which is coming and blowing, but it's the kind of thing which is sort of just knocking and knocking and knocking and knocking on the door. And that's, it's just interesting that it's the door, which is going to become a theme also when we end up leaving, is together with this east wind which is blowing. Now, when we live in Israel, when we have really bad weather, then they generally call it either a chamsan or a sharav. The sharav, I'm not sure if it's exactly an east wind. I think it's more east and south, but it's I'm just wondering out loud if that's the kind of thing they're referring to, which means when you have nice weather in the summer, the wind is coming from the Mediterranean, and that's going to generally be a cooler kind of a breeze. And when you can have the terribly hot days, it's when the sharav is almost literally, I think it's literally, a wind coming in from the Sahara Desert. Sharav will be a wind coming in from the desert, which will be a hot desert wind. And if it's really a strong, if it's really a stronger wind, it's going to drop a lot of sand, and it's going to get everything dirty, and it's going to get, which makes cleaning somewhat more challenging, which is why I don't bother. And the word chamsin, from what I understand, is related to the to a legend among an Islamic legend that there are 50 such days a year. Chamsin is 50. So chamsin, there are 50 hot days a year. So therefore, that's why they call it chamsin, as opposed to our calling it sharav. Again, don't trust me on my Arab legends, but that's what I've heard. Rashi is also going to tell us. Look at source 20, because this is here by the splitting of the sea. Beruach kadim azah. Beruach kadim shaya azah shebaruchot hi haruach shekadosh baruch hu nefra ba min harishaim. This is the wind which is used that God pays back the wicked. The east wind. It's a thing. I'll just put it like that. In source 21, which is in Bechukotai, there it speaks about our existence in Galut as being kol ale nidaf. This is as a driven leaf comes from this. Kol ale nidaf. And Rashi writes, ale nidaf, shaharuach tochafo umakeu al ale acher umekashkesh umotzi kol. Again, it's this constant wind which is blowing and producing a sound. V'chein targumo kal tarfa deshakif, loshon chavata, shtufot kadim, shikifon kadom, loshon mashkof, makom chavata tadelet, which means it's this wind which is blowing and causing the door to be knocking. There's a couple of more places where Rashi does this as well, which speaks about the wind which is blowing and is knocking. And but I think the main issue really was this idea of the east wind. The pages that I had a little bit further that they gave to you, they were too nice and they gave to you. First of all the Rashis I just cited, and on page 5 you have them all in English, if you do need them, and probably even a little bit more so than the ones that I gave. But what I found particularly interesting, and I was looking for this, was the meaning of the east wind and how other people had taken it. So, as I said, you have this all in front of you now. So, in Greek mythology, there is a Urus, right? It's the east wind. In Native American Iroquois culture, the east wind is said to be brought about by an Oyanduni. I hope I just didn't say Avodah Zarah. The moose spirit, whose breath blows gray mist and sends down cold rains upon the earth. On the top of the next page, we'll go to the third paragraph. The east wind symbolizes change in P.L. Travers' Mary Poppins. Mary Poppins arrives at the Banks house carried by the east wind, but warns the children she'll only stay until the wind changes. At the end of the book, the west wind carries her away, which, by the way, is the opposite of the theology that Rashi expressed, because then she should have come. I mean, the bad news comes in on the east. The east is punishment. But so therefore, you could decide now if Mary Poppins was actually an anti-hero or not. In Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes story, His Last Bow, published in 1917, but set in 1914, so you have World War I there as the issue in the background, ends with Holmes addressing his assistant, Dr. Watson, on the eve of the First World War. There's an east wind coming, Watson. I think not, Holmes. It's very warm. Good old Watson, you're the one fixed point in a changing age. There's an east wind coming all the same, such a wind that has never blew on England yet. It will be cold and bitter, Watson, and a good many of us may wither before its blast. But it's God's own wind nonetheless, and a cleaner, better, stronger land will lie in the sunshine when the storm has cleared. I mean, I think it's absolutely amazing that quote. I mean, that's he put God in this, because this is purely a biblical reference. I mean, if only World War I would have produced a better world afterwards, and instead of producing the you know, everything set for World War II. So again, I want to think about the various things that we saw. Is that you know, on the one hand, we have in this plague of darkness this idea that instead of what should have been the easier read of the text, we have this subtext that Chazal are telling us. On the one hand, oh, it's really good because we were able to go in and case the joint and take and either take what we wanted or at least point our fingers later what we wanted. And then you have this other terrible teaching. I say terrible not in the sense that it's bad. It's this terrible thought that so many people died and we were busy burying during that time. And that means that we're suffering our own darkness, even though there was plenty of light. But it's also interesting how it's being pointed. But what was the problem is that they did not want to be part of those who were leaving. And therefore, if you don't want to be part of this this epic historical drama, then God says, okay, so you want to stay here in Egypt, you'll stay on my terms, not on your terms, because Egypt is over. Egypt is over, and you're going to stay. So then you're going to stay dead and buried, but you're not staying. There is no life in Egypt anymore. That has come to an end. And I said, it's such a frightful teaching. And on the other hand, when we looked at the other two makot, and I can go in two different directions. When I look at the makot in terms of the makot b'charot, well, there is an element there, but what's most important is it's avoided. It's what God gives us a way of solving the problem. Yes, the plague is coming, and it's coming for everybody, but you can now do a religious act. You can now serve God, and now you can put the thing on your doorpost, which is all the more interesting now in terms of the doorpost. Again, that knocking of the wind blowing on the doorpost, that you can put something on the doorpost and that then will prevent the plague. And that connection to the doorpost is one that I never would have imagined had I not gone checking all of these times where the east wind is mentioned. And then I see suddenly, oh, the doorpost is there as well. I mean, there's even a Rashi that connects it with Bikurim, with the first fruits, which is not Bukharot, but that's a Rashi which is later on. If you need to see where the Rashi is, it was mentioned a couple times in the Rashis that we saw. Right. The other place is in source 23, where it says on the one hand, Lo tavash al gadi b'chalevimo, and then aser taser, ma'inyan zayt solzeh. What does it have to do the other? Malakadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael, al tigrumuli levashel gadiim shel tfua ad shehem b'mei imatam. She'im einatem ma'asrim ma'asrot karoi shehu samuch litbashel ani motzi ruach kadim v'hi mishadafon shenemar u'shtefa lefnei kama v'chein le'inyan bikurim. So again, I didn't explain the whole thing, but the same thing again. If you don't do this and this properly, then I'm going to take out the east wind again. And the east wind is always this thing of punishment. So it's quite remarkable that Mary Poppins comes in on the east wind. I don't know how I'm getting past that point, but you see, the author of Sherlock Holmes was far more theologically attuned than the author of Mary Poppins, unless Mary Poppins and giving discipline to children is actually quite evil. It's actually entertaining children is quite evil. So maybe disciplining is the right thing. So I don't even know what to begin to do with this. We'll leave this for all of you to figure out. I'm gonna end. Yeah, and now I can start thinking of every east and west and every time. Good, the witch of the good, excellent. You'll have to watch The Wizard of Oz again. In source 25. By the way, the book versus the movie. I don't know. I'm just bringing. In source 25 in Yeshayahu, and maybe this will all become a little bit more meaningful. It talks about issues having to do with the ends of days. One of the things that it points out is in Pasuk Chet. It talks about Beruchoa Kasha Biyom Kadim. It talks about this wind which is coming and it will be delivering the punishment of those who are deserving it. L'chein b'zot yuchaper avon, and that is the way in order to create purity. And it continues in Pasuk Yud Bet, V'yob yomahu yechabot mishibolet hanahar al nachal Mitzrayim, which now, of course, we realize are biblical descriptions of the past and the future coming in. V'atem tiklatu le'achad echad mibnei Yisrael, V'yob yomahu yitaka b'shofar gadol, which I also want to make note of this. A shofar is something which is blown. The sound is produced also with the wind. With the smallest type of wind? With the breath. That breath is a breath which can be associated with God breathing a breath into man and giving him the spirit of life, and then a shema, literally a breath of God. And over here you have the breath Again, mitzvah done with the breath is interesting because it's really, in a certain sense, the opposite of this wind which comes to punish. And it says instead, that all those who've been lost throughout history end up coming back and coming to Jerusalem. So again, going back to this theme, which some people will like and some people won't like, that if there is this punishment during the days of darkness, that punishment took place because they did not want to be part of history. They didn't want to continue their path. They didn't want to go and head towards Israel as they were supposed to. But one day it's going to come, and this wind is going to come, and it's going to fix whatever tikkun, whatever needs to be fixed. But eventually the sound is going to come and blow this great shofar, and then you have this incredible tikkun will take place. But part of what we learned along the way was to notice to what extent the plague of locusts was actually, you know, again, these last three plagues was actually foreshadowing, because we've just always looked at it independently, but to what extent it was foreshadowing the splitting of the sea and the wind which is coming, and therefore, I'm saying on a literary sense, it's beautiful, that Paro's there looking, and then they say, oh, this is death. Yeah, it's death. Indeed, this is going to be the death, but they don't realize what it is. They just think it's the locust without realizing it's the process. Because you're going to repeat this process, and when this process repeats, you're going to end up being, the sea is going to split by this taking place, and then the punishment is going to end up taking place. So, as I said, you know, the closer reading of the plagues, I think, reveals things that we hadn't noticed before, and the comparison between plagues ends up comparing certain things, revealing certain things that we hadn't noticed before. And this sense of the Jews nonetheless being punished is one which I think, I find quite disturbing. And I never would have imagined that pasuk of Chamushim, you know, to be suggested that you take it literally. And even the context of the Mechilta, it wasn't trying to tell you how many people died. It was trying to express why they were so delighted to find out that they were going to have children in the future. And in the midst of a Holocaust, in the midst of a slavery, to hear that children will survive and we will one day have free children. So there's not a better blessing than that. And that seems to be the response in that Mechilta. But then it seems to be that this teaching takes this life of its own and ends up talking about how many of the percentages that don't end up making it out. And again, that's very, very that's very frightening, you know. And our wish and our thought and our prayer is that Jews all over the world wake up and understand that every generation has a historical mission to it. And that historical mission is one that we are far better off being a part of and building it rather than watching it being reported in a distorted way on CNN.